Welcoming you to Be In The Know. Jump on and hold tight as we take you on a managerial merry-go-round. We're joined by the Evening Standard's chief football correspondent, Dan Kilpatrick, to discuss the startling developments at Spurs. The Daily Mail's Northern football reporter, Jack Gawne, to discuss the impact of Solskjaer's tactical masterclass. Oh, yes, Ollie. And we preview the big one this weekend, the Manchester Derby. Is Rodgers still in the reckoning if there becomes an opening at Old Trafford? We're joined by the PA's Midlands football writer, Nick Masheter, to discuss. And we look to Villa Park and ask if Smith will be given time to adapt to life without Jack. Crystal Palace chairman Steve Parrish tried to sign Espirito Santo for Crystal Palace, but had to settle for Vieira. What does Palace's win say about Manchester City? And could West Ham versus Liverpool upstage the Manchester Derby? Two of the top performing sides of the season clashing in the capital. And we run a rule over the next youngsters pushing for a place in Gareth Southgate's squad for Qatar 2022. But first, we have to start at Tottenham Hotspur's training ground. Dan, thank you for joining us. A remarkable, remarkable weekend. Everything sparked by that Moura substitute.
Yeah, it really was. I was quite surprised by the trigger. I never thought that Nuno substituting Lucas Moura would be the thing to really set the fans off, but it had been coming, and it wasn't just about Nuno. It was about the decisions the club have made, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years. But nonetheless, it was toxic. And I think the reaction of the fans on Saturday was really the thing that persuaded Daniel Levy and the club to act on Monday morning. From what I heard from the club before the game, there was no real thought about replacing Nuno afterwards. I know the game was dubbed El Sacico and it was all about Ollie and Nuno, but I still think the real pressure was on Ollie going into the game. And actually, there was a kind of view at Spurs that they were starting a new cycle, that it was going to be a long-term thing, and actually they shouldn't make any really hasty decisions, even if they were concerned about results and performances. But the atmosphere on Saturday just completely changed all that, and I think the club realised that it was completely unsustainable to carry on going in that direction.
Why didn't Conte happen in the summer, and why can it happen now?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. The second part there is what's changed since the summer? I mean, from what I understand in the summer, Conte wasn't particularly impressed with the club's assurances over rebuilding the squad, over transfer spending, and there were reservations on Spurs' side about whether Conte was the right manager to work with the squad they had. You know, they were certainly concerned about whether he would work with young players. I think they knew back then that Oliver Skipp, for instance, was going to be a big part of the team this season, as he has been so far under Nuno, and they were concerned about whether Conte, you know, would be able to or wanted to work with someone like that who was still very raw. I suspect what's changed is that Spurs are more desperate and Conte is probably more desperate to get back and work, given that he has been out of a job since walking out on Inter at the end of last season. So there's probably more willingness on both sides to make concessions. But I strongly suspect that most of those concessions are going to come from Spurs, because they're just in a more desperate position now. The Nuno experiment has failed miserably. Levy can scarcely afford to get it wrong. He's going to have to shelve this idea of a rebuild and a new cycle and a new project again. He's going to have to commit to backing Nuno in January, backing Conte, sorry, if he gets the job in January and beyond. So I suspect, you know, from Conte's point of view, you know, he might well end up with a much better deal and much more promises than he would have done had he been kind of more willing to take the job in June.
We know that he expects commitment from his players. He's not afraid to put other players out onto a training ground with the second team. Will Harry Kane buy into his ideas, do you believe, or has the ship sailed?
I think Kane will buy into his ideas. I think Kane will recognise a world-class coach when he sees one. Yeah, he's very intelligent when it comes to football, I think, Kane. And I think there are plenty of reasons for Kane's form this season. Fatigue after the Euros being won. There's plenty of other England players who haven't done it. Playing in Nuno's just awful team, who are the least creative outside of Norwich in the Premier League, and the least exciting outside of Norwich in the Premier League, is another reason. And I think being disinterested and kind of checking out is also a reason. But, you know, you'd like to think that the pretty much all three of those would change under Conte. You know, he'll get the side fitter, he'll get everyone motivated and on board. And if they're not, as you said, they'll be out in the cold. He's, you know, a world-class manager who knows how to organise his team. And I'm sure would create more chances under Nuno than they did under Conte than they did under Nuno, which is obviously, you know, good news for Harry Kane.
Who will be his Victor Moses? I did ask Nuno if he would think of swapping to a back three. We can pretty much agree, I think, that Conte will. Have they got the team to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think with Conte, I don't think he'll necessarily go for a back three. I think he's pragmatic in that he will choose the formation that best suits the squad, and he will make a call on whether he thinks that's a back three. And there's definitely good reason to think that that system would work with the Spurs squad. You've got quite a leaky defence with two fullbacks who like to attack in Royal and Reguilon. You've got Romero, who looks like a very good defender who played in a back three at Atalanta all of last season, where he was Italian Defender of the Year or Serie A Defender of the Year. So immediately it makes sense. And you've got a midfield that looks like they, you know, might work well, in Ndombele, Lo Celso in that system as well. So I could definitely see it. But I think he'll make a call based on the squad he finds if he gets the job. As for who is Victor Moses could be, I mean, you're looking at the same names again, aren't you? I mean, players who just either haven't been coached properly, like Ndombele or Bergwijn or Lo Celso, or players whose commitment has been in question, like Winks and Dele. But there's so many players at Spurs who have been underwhelming pretty much since the Champions League final. So, you know, any one of those is just waiting to be revived by a proper progressive, authoritative coach.
I suppose the biggest question, we've seen him inspire players before. Could he persuade Kane to stay?
Yeah, I mean, I think he could. I mean, the thing with Kane ultimately comes back to suitors and, you know, who's willing to actually spend the money on him. Because even at the end of the season, he's going to have 2 years left in his contract. That Levy could still demand 100 million for him. He's still going to be the England captain, no matter, you know, how the rest of the season plays out. He's still going to be Harry Kane. So, you know, the question is, do City or United perhaps, or you know, someone on the continent want him that badly? And I'm not convinced there is a club that wants him that badly, to be honest. So, you know, as we sit here, there's every chance, you know, Kane comes around to the idea of signing a contract and kind of commits himself to Spurs. And it's, you know, it doesn't matter who's in the dugout, it's just circumstance. But certainly if there's kind of any manager who could, you know, persuade Kane that Spurs can get back on the up and back on the right track, then it's Conte, because his record, you know, speaks for itself.
Tottenham are a European Conference League side. Conte, one of the most successful managers behind Guardiola in this generation. It's a massive coup to pull this off.
Yeah, it's an astonishing coup, really. But nonetheless, you would have to say it's not without its risks for Spurs, which really reflects on the state of the club, but also on Conte's character and the character of Levy as well. So I think Spurs have got themselves a genuine world-class manager, which is a real surprise given how they've fallen since Pochettino was sacked. And given, you know, their standing in the Premier League and European football, as you said. But nonetheless, he's a manager that, you know, is highly combustible, is very demanding, wants instant success. So the club's going to have to make concessions, and the club's going to have to work very, very hard to keep him happy. So I think, yeah, you look at the appointment and you think that's the best possible manager Spurs could have got, best available manager. But nonetheless, you can't help but worry about it potentially blowing up in their faces at some point down the line, because that's the nature of Conte, that's the nature of Levy, and that's the kind of state Spurs are in.
Nuno given enough time?
Yeah, he was given enough time. There was nothing in his reign to suggest that he was the right appointment and to suggest that the concerns about him initially were kind of unfounded or misplaced. It was only getting worse. It was only going one way. And I think even before the United game, it was unsustainable. A big mistake, but it wasn't a mistake to get rid of him when they did. It would have been an error to let that one run and let that one fester, because the football would have got no better and the atmosphere would have got even worse.
Jack, thank you for waiting. A lot of ground to cover there, though. We really thought that it was Ollie who was under the cosh, but it has to be said, a tactical masterstroke from him, which has saved his job.
He's always been at his best at United when met with a crisis, which is to his credit. And I found it almost quite amusing on Friday in his press conference that he was almost boastful in a weird way that there've been two or three different crises while he's been manager. I thought the big thing about Saturday, and I don't think Solskjaer would admit this, and I wouldn't expect him to admit it, is that there felt like an element of him swallowing his pride tactically, going back to the back three, making them more kind of resolute. You know, it's a back three, but it's a back five without the ball. I think that is actually quite good management at the weekend, and he should be applauded for it, because we all knew what the deficiencies were, but it's one thing knowing what the deficiencies are and another thing acting on them. And he just made them harder to play against. There weren't those open spaces through the middle. It masked the problem of the central midfield to an extent. And they've got the quality going forward to hit teams where it hurts. And he was pragmatic. And that's what got him the result.
The big question in the boardroom was that there was a split over Conte. Have you any idea who else they may be signalling to, other than perhaps Pochettino if he should leave PSG? Or it seems to me that seems the alternative. What do you think now? Where are we in terms of, if it all goes wrong for Ollie next weekend, who could come in?
Similar to the Tottenham thing, really, in the sense that there aren't that many managers that you would want and are attainable mid-season. Now, Brendan Rodgers has got a lot of admirers at United. I don't think the Liverpool thing would be a massive problem if he was to take the job. But yeah, there aren't many. And the big thing is, I don't think there's anyone internally that you could turn around and say, it's yours for 6 months until we wait for someone. Because it's like the names that you think are, you know, Rodgers, Nagelsmann, but Nagelsmann's now not attainable for the next at least 18 months. So it's strange, isn't it? There's not that many options. And they've always been so, United have always been so resistant to make a change for a number of different reasons, but I don't think Woodward wants another sacking on his CV before he goes. And they've always wanted to give Ollie as much time as possible. And they obviously look at that squad and say, we've got enough quality players in there to drag us out of this mess. And the bigger the game, the better they perform generally, Liverpool aside, last week, obviously.
It does mean Nuno is now available, which obviously Tottenham fans will be thinking, yeah, so who cares? But Nick Amashita in the Midlands, who worked with Nuno extensively at Wolves, isn't he the perfect fit for Newcastle?
Possibly. I think the biggest thing for Nuno was that he was clearly tired when he left Wolves. He clearly essentially sort of run out of steam, and he had taken them as far as he could. And perhaps one of the reasons why it failed so badly for him at Tottenham was he needed a break, and he needs a break. So I would still be surprised whether, if he came straight back into a job, especially in the Premier League, you know, he's not obviously seen his family as much as he would have liked to over the last 4 years or so, including with a pandemic in the middle of that. And is his star fallen a little bit? I think if Tottenham had got the Nuno of 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I think we could be looking at something quite different. He gave Wolves an identity, and that's something that Tottenham have clearly been lacking for a while now. But now, is he star on the way, and is he slightly damaged goods? And I don't think Newcastle will the first manager that comes into Newcastle is probably not the manager that's going to get them to the Champions League. They need somebody who knows how to get themselves out of that situation firstly. But I don't think that would be Nuno. If it was me advising him, I'd be telling him to take a little break and relax on his plot of land on the hill in Portugal.
Which has got a nice little Brucey sacking bonus as well, so we can't feel too sorry about him. Although a good guy, we do actually. But yeah, Jack, let's move on to the next stop on this magical on this managerial merry-go-round, because you were at the Etihad and remarkably, Steve Parrish was going to go for Nuno. Nuno went to Tottenham and he brought in Patrick Vieira. How happy is he going to be today?
I know, it's funny game, isn't it? And it's about the Vieira story is really, really interesting, because when he retired as a player at Man City, they allowed him to look at every part of the business for 2 years. So he learned everything about the football side and the business side. They said, "Oh, we want you to find out what you want to do after retirement." So he spent a long time doing that, and then he went to New York City. And they were kind of, he did okay at New York, but they were always kind of like the nearly men in MLS, even though they made some big signings when he was manager. And then went to Nice, and I don't follow Nice's results that closely, but I'd follow someone on Twitter who is a Nice fan. And he said very, very early on, he was insistent that Patrick Vieira wasn't the man for them. And it came as no surprise to him, and presumably a lot of other Nice fans, that Vieira left the club in 2020. So to go from that to then, I don't want to say transform because they've only played 10 games, but Palace feels like a completely different place at the moment. Like the mood's up. I didn't think there was any great surprise that they played like they played on Saturday and got a result. And he's been quite unfortunate not to pick up a few more victories. So, yeah, the mood has shifted dramatically. He's got some exceptional players going forward. I just really surprised at how well it's gone so quickly.
The funny thing, I was at the academy launch with Steve and Patrick, and I was speaking to them both about, okay, you haven't got the win, but you're playing so well, you know it will come. And there was actually quite a lot of apprehension. What if it doesn't come from both of them? Patrick was being very honest. Steve was saying, Patrick's very honest. You know, he knows there's things that's got to change. And you're just like, you both think this might not come. And I said, you know, stranger things have happened with going to City. You might get something. And Steve went, oh, we have actually beaten them there before. But in terms of, I think a lot of people, they see it now, but they weren't believing it because they don't get to see the Palace in the flesh, but why so good? We know Connor's just exceptional, but they've got the recruitment has been excellent, hasn't it?
Yeah, and you look at the best signing they've made in recent years isn't even playing for them at the moment. He's still injured, Deze, to come back. And you look at, like, me and Nick have watched Mark Guéhi play for the England under-21s a lot over the last couple of years, and you could just tell the first time I saw him play, I was like, he is going to be an exceptional defender. And to pay that much money for someone who is that young and without Premier League experience was probably considered a gamble by people outside of the football club. But I've barely seen him put a foot wrong for England. Similar with Conor Gallagher, who's an really, really good short-term signing. And then Edouard, like, half of the Premier League wanted Edouard, didn't they? And it never happened for countless reasons with other clubs, including Brighton. And they've got someone who can get them 10, 15 goals, which is something that Palace haven't had for a long time.
So, a big surprise on that day. No surprise, though, Nick, in the Midlands, that West Ham prevailed over Aston Villa. But Dean Smith, he can't really be in trouble, can he?
Naturally, there's always going to be murmurings that managers are only ever 2, 3, 4 games away from a crisis anyway. So... But it's only a month ago they went to Manchester United and won. And one kind of rotten month for poor results, and again, by and large, poor performances, shouldn't really overshadow what has been three really good years of progress under Dean Smith. They are now, or they should be, back to where they were pre-relegation. And you know, that was a shell of a club at the end of the Paul Lambert era, and Tim, and sort of over the course of Tim Sherwood, Remy Gard reigns. They went through managers like anything, and Dean is a builder. He gives you he gives you that consistency and that sustainability. And realistically, I think you really shouldn't judge things on the last four games. There's a lot of turnover. Of course, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about the how they try to replace Jack Grealish. And yeah, look, just four poor results should not see him put under the pressure that others have been under previously.
Should Konsa have been sent off?
I mean, there's I would say, yeah, I think there's probably two red cards there anyway, wasn't there? For both centre backs. So yeah, I think I've known Dean for a very long time. I've got an awful lot of respect and time for him. I've known him since he was head of youth at Walsall. Came in 2009 there. Dean likes to rally against referees sometimes. We saw that again at the weekend, but I think he's probably fighting a losing battle on that one.
Jack, West Ham versus Liverpool, that's suddenly looking really tasty, especially after that surprise draw. No surprise, though, considering the opponents, perhaps. But could Moyes do one over Jürgen?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think I'm contractually obliged to say that the Manchester Derby is the biggest game next weekend because of where I live and work. But I think West Ham-Liverpool might be the best game of the weekend. I'm really kind of really looking forward to watching that. West Ham, just club reborn, aren't they? With a manager that's reborn. So many good technical players in midfield. And yeah, you say the Liverpool result wasn't a massive surprise given the opposition on at the weekend, and it wasn't. And it's kind of cliched, but this is what the Premier League's renowned for, and that's why it's so good. That if you have a 20, 25 minutes in a game where you're not at it, the opposition will find ways to hurt you. And that was exactly the same at City on Saturday as well, which I thought those two results showcased the Premier League for what a brilliant division it is.
Nick, I missed out on another one on the managerial merry-go-round because Brendan Rodgers was being tipped to go to Old Trafford in the week. What is happening with Leicester?
It's an interesting one. Naturally, the defensive problems have been the biggest kind of sort of Achilles heel for them over the course of the season. Johnny Evans is just such a miss with the foot injury that he's been carrying from the back end of last season, which forced him off in the FA Cup final as well. Charles Soyuncu as well is seemingly fairly error prone at the minute. James Justin is close to coming back from his serious knee injury. Wesley Fofana obviously broke his leg in the summer. So you're arguably missing 50% of your first choice starting defence, 75% if Johnny Evans isn't there. So I think that tells a massive story. They're not able to put out a full strength side. Wilfred Ndidi's been out as well, which is a huge, huge loss for them, as well as Samare has done, for instance, when he's come in. There are not excuses, but there are reasons for why Leicester haven't hit the heights. James Maddison has obviously been out of form as well, but you know, he's a young man. He's just become a father as well, fairly recently in the last few months. So you can't underestimate the impact that would have, that does have on everybody's life and work. I'm not saying that's been a distraction for him, but naturally you're going to be a bit more tired. Yeah, there are a few things there, but again, like Dean Smith and like Aston Villa, Leicester won the FA Cup for the first time ever in May, they've been pushing the Champions League places really, really hard for the last two seasons. They're in Europe again. this isn't a club that's suddenly kind of fallen away and is sitting 17th and really struggling. So they've got the players, they've got the manager, they've got the infrastructure. It's a club that that really does do things with a touch of class as well on and off the pitch. So I'm not overly concerned just yet, but it's just that that bar at Leicester has been set a lot higher since Brendan's come in. They've just not hit that just yet.
Jack, although we don't underestimate and Liverpool will respect Graham Potter's men, as he talks of, I think they gained him more respect. Is there anything concerning about that performance from Jurgen Klopp's team? They've got a big week, Atletico Madrid, and the return of that fixture, which we all remember pre-COVID, the final match. But absolutely ran Manchester United rugged. But then just a point against Brighton, it's showing areas of concern, isn't it?
These things can happen. They happen to the best teams. It happened with City loads of times, covering them after winning titles or whenever. I think with Liverpool as well, Naby Keita coming off early probably changed the game slightly. They have concerns in midfield, injury-wise. Fabinho's still not fit. Thiago's not fit. Keita won't play midweek, I don't think. And he'll go strong against Atletico, but that qualification's effectively sewn up already, isn't it? And they'll probably go strong and get it completely nailed, and then go into the West Ham game with a resounding victory, because Liverpool are a momentum team, aren't they? If they play well midweek, they'll probably play well at the weekend as well.
The thing with David Moyes though, Nick, is that he's playing the same team time and time again, and that's eventually going to tell, isn't it? How far do you think they can finish? Where do you think they can finish at the end of the season?
Well, the top three is sewn up, isn't it? There's really only kind of one Champions League spot to play for in fourth place. With Manchester United faltering, with Tottenham where they are, with Arsenal, despite the sort of recent resurgence, why can't West Ham push the boundaries and get that fourth spot? David Moyes has done it before with Everton. He got them into the Champions League. What we're talking. Just under 20 odd years ago, 15 years ago, 16 years ago, maybe. So why can't he do it? He's done it before, albeit, of course, sort of in a slightly different Premier League era. But if they've got the rehab, the recovery, the prehab correct, I think the prehab is probably the most important thing out of all of that. Why can't they? The momentum and confidence is there. And they've just got to maintain it. That's the critical thing. That's the difficult thing. But they've got the experience. I think David Moyes has shown himself to be the good manager that everybody thought he was and knew he was at Everton. And things went a little bit awry for him after that. But he's doing an exceptional job. He's got the team. The fourth goal against Aston Villa on Sunday was just. It was just class. It really was slick, just really underlined the confidence that they're playing with at the minute.
It was really summed up everything about West Ham, didn't it? It was if you want to pick out a goal to sum up that team and to sum up a David Moyes team, I agree. It was wonderful. Talking of Everton, Jack, will Rafa be relishing a Tottenham team in turmoil, or with Conte at the helm, is that a daunting prospect?
His new manager bounce still a thing? I don't know whether it is or not, but you don't want to be playing a team with a new manager if you can help it. And Everton have been a little bit up and down. I've quite enjoyed watching them play this year. Damari Gray as well, like, come from nowhere, wasn't expecting that at all. He's looking like quite a shrewd signing, but it's up front, isn't it, for Everton? When Calvert-Lewin's not about, you do wonder who's going to score on the goals. But the one thing about Benitez teams is that they'll always be so well drilled, and they will nick results. And I was talking to Peter Crouch, did a column for us earlier in the season about Rafa Benitez, and he firmly believes that he'll end up being loved by both sides of Merseyside, and I'm not going to argue with him.
I have to ask you about the big one then. Let's do it. It is the derby. Is it just a stay of oxygen? Is it okay? I can use this phrase for this club. I actually stopped myself using this phrase in relation to Bruce the other day, and we all as journalists know why, but simply with the Manchester derby coming so thick and so fast, is it just a stay of execution for Ollie?
I think it is generally, yeah. And it's certainly the feeling last Monday after the Liverpool game was that he really hasn't got long left. But then things change so quickly. But then, you know, if they go and lose by 3 or 4 on Saturday, which they could do, because City will be wounded by the weekend, and always, well, by and large, play very well at Old Trafford. If that happens, then we're back to last Monday again. And it's sad because he's obviously a nice guy and everything that goes with that, but it does feel as if it is coming towards the end. Ollie even got asked about it actually the other day on the telly, that the messaging has changed from United. It was backing him 100% to kind of slightly softer, and we all know that reading, you know, you, in this job you read between the lines, don't you?
Cavani, is that the best way that Ronaldo can work, that two-prong attack? Because I watched Cavani sprint in the warm-up at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. I couldn't believe how fast he was. It's ridiculous. It was just a flash of lightning. I was like, who's that? It cannot be Cavani. He's just putting everyone else's cartilage over the age of 30 to shame.
Just hair everywhere.
This flash. But ultimately, has Ronaldo got the legs? Does he need someone running around just so he can do what he does best?
Yeah, you can play him and Cavani together, but I think you have to pick your moments. You can't do that every week. And you look at the bench at the weekend, you have Marcus Rashford and Mason Greenwood on the bench. And I love watching both of those players play through the middle. Rashford kind of very effective from the left. Greenwood surely will be a central striker in future. And I would really relish watching him alongside Ronaldo. Because I think you're right. I think someone running... doing the running for Ronaldo, I know that's blunt, but basically that's what it is. He could be very effective with someone like that. And it's just a little bit of a shame that they can't play 4-2-3-1 really with Fernandes in behind Ronaldo, because they take up the same positions. And I remember the homecoming for Ronaldo, the Newcastle game, coming away from that going, well, Fernandes and Ronaldo are taking the same positions up, but this is... you can look at it positively because they can pop the ball off really, really quickly and play in those small spaces. But actually, since then, it has looked like a little bit of a problem.
Nick, I think you could... actually, it's fine, Jack, for you to put that bluntly, because Poyet said exactly the same thing to us pre-match. He said he's finally found someone to do the running for him. Nick, from the outside looking in, how surprised were you when he brought in Cavani and the turnaround? And do you think... can you see there's any way that he can turn the tables on Guardiola, who may... his team may be a bit shaken despite that remarkable bench by Crystal Palace's victory?
Yeah, I guess on the face of it, when Cavani came in, it may look like a little bit of a panic signing, just a real stopgap, when we need somebody, this is the man for right now rather than the right man. But he seems to have worked for him. I don't see United... of course, every week, but it's probably done as well as to be expected, really. And I know it might be damning with faint praise there, but I don't think we could be expected much more. With regards to the derby, it's still difficult for just to see Ollie outsmarting somebody tactically. City naturally aren't at the top of their game at the minute. They're still missing that striker. If they had Kane, then would they be streaking ahead at the top of the table? Who knows? But I would still make City favourites quite comfortably as well.
Jack, I think the one thing with that team when it was announced was that concern. The two players that were on the bench, Rashford and Greenwood, particularly Greenwood, and Ollie coming in. Of course, so much was made of the fact that he was coaching the youth team, had brought these players through, and then on the day that he needs to make his big statement, the future of United are on the bench. How much did Rashford's goal sort of save him from that? But how much will that be something being reckoned with in the boardroom?
No, I think it's one game. Solskjaer's shown that he's quite happy to throw these players in, particularly with Greenwood. Obviously, Rashford was already a first-team player. But with Greenwood, he had absolutely no qualms in giving him his opportunity. He's racked up loads and loads of appearances in the Premier League already. This is what they want from Solskjaer. What Solskjaer's done is what they've wanted from him, in that they talk about a kind of cultural reset. They wanted the younger players to play, and he's bedded some of them in. And that's not going to change just because Cavani and Ronaldo play well at Tottenham. Because as I was saying before, you can't play those two together every week. It's impossible. United, like all the other top teams, play three times a week. So therefore, Greenwood's and Rashford, when Rashford's properly fully fit, they're going to play plenty of minutes.
And I do want to keep one issue and banging of the drum going, because we've stopped the Super League and we're all very vocal about that. But one thing that seems to be going a little too far under the radar for me is the IFAB ruling that they would like, a proposal that they would like the five sub rule to be a permanent thing. Nick and Jack, I'll go to you first. Nick, what would that mean for the Premier League, who have staved it off so far?
The wider thing, I mean, we've seen it for a long time anyway, but the stockpiling of players from bigger clubs, just allow them to have that strongest squad. I think that was the complaints from some. I'm sure Dean Smith was vocal about it previously, that it allows the Manchester City, United, Chelsea, whoever, to bring on these kind of 60, 70, 80 million pound players off the bench with 10 minutes to go and change the game quickly. So I'm sure that there would be opposition from probably half the Premier League, and the other half of the Premier League clubs would be probably quite quietly happy about it. It's a shame, because it's tradition, isn't it? It's starting to kind of sort of take the tradition away. And I know football has progressed from no subs to one sub to only having three on the bench, and then you have seven and things like that. But I think the three sub rule has been around for such a long time. I'm loath to see. I don't fear change, but it kind of makes me a bit sad.
Jack, is this just a way to appease the super clubs? Just a softer, more gentle way for the likes of Man United to feel they're being separated from the super state-owned clubs, and is it going to pass? Do you just think it's inevitable?
I think it is inevitable, eventually. I know the Premier League have been very resistant to it, haven't they? The one thing, I'm surprised that so many managers are against it, even the ones with smaller squads, because it basically takes away the jeopardy of a substitution. Like, you've only got three, you've got to get it right. And in essence, it kind of makes a manager's job easier. So I have been a little bit taken aback that loads and loads of managers are against it. I mean, it's funny, because I cover Guardiola every week, and Guardiola's with Klopp is the one that is really kind of getting behind this, and this is what he wants. And his argument is for it helps the players stave off injuries and all that sort of stuff. He wants five subs, never uses five subs when they're available, ever.
Klopp's the same.
It's nice having them, but they never actually use them.
It does ruin team news a bit. They're in the starting 11, everyone else is on the bench. takes away that a bit. Right, we have put the world to rights. I think we probably could have connected every manager in that merry-go-round if we tried. I'll put more effort in next time. We are going to have time for our unsung hero of the season or of the week for your pick. Let's start with you, Nick.
I had two. And he's already been mentioned in passing by Jack but so I'm going to go for somebody else who hasn't been mentioned, And it's a manager, and it's Sean Dyche after 9 years at Burnley. There's sort of so much expectation surrounding sort of Premier League clubs, and I'm not saying that Burnley don't have that expectation to progress and succeed, but what Dyche has done has been exceptional on a budget. He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows exactly what they need to do to get to where they need to go. I saw them at Leicester earlier in the season. Obviously, they've struggled to win earlier in the season, and they were clearly in a false position. So Dyche has done and continues to do an exceptional job at Burnley.
Over to Dan, who's come back from filing the latest on Conte and that craziness. What about you?
I'm going to go for Mikel Antonio. I know he does get a lot of praise, but genuinely, now that Harry Kane has kind of fallen off this cliff, I don't think there's any centre forward in the Premier League I'd kind of rather have playing up front by himself than Antonio. And at the moment, I'm including Lukaku in that. He's so good at every aspect of playing as a lone striker. And I think he's been hugely important to West Ham's rise. He is starting to obviously get the recognition, but he's a really, really good player. And I think he probably deserves even more recognition than he's getting.
I wasn't convinced when you said you were going to say Antonio, but absolutely deserving. Well argued, sir. And finally, Jack, can you win it?
Well, I'm actually going for Conor Gallagher, so apologies to Nick, because hopefully my reaction stopped him from saying Conor Gallagher. Purely because, and I know we got headlines at the weekend because the goal, but Conor Gallagher had heart surgery a year before he went to Charlton on loan in 2019. He had to play in the Championship, learn the game. And I think we overlook what it takes to become a Premier League footballer sometimes. And it's an exceptionally long road, and people like that should be applauded, particularly as Gallagher has gone through some serious issues in his very young life. I think he's showing this. He showed last year he was a standout at West Brom, and he's showing this year that he's added an extra dimension to his game, and you wonder how far he can go.
Nick's face when you said Connor. Fury. And he has actually won already this season, but that is a whole new angle on why. And you have just Manchester City, his awareness on the ball, that he's got that quality that he slows down time, doesn't he? He's incredible. We're all big fans. I think I was texting Nick during the under-21s, not the last match one before, just saying how magnificent he is. But an absolute talent, so exciting. We've got the I didn't even flag this to you. We've got Southgate obviously naming his squad. Do you think Connor and Smith Rowe will go in yet, or is he going to be more cautious?
More cautious, I think, and also hope, because I want Smith Rowe and Gallagher to be playing for the under-21s, because it makes it more interesting for me and Nick. I don't know how close Gallagher is. I think Smith Rowe is probably closer, just because of his style of play. There's so much talent in that under-21s group. There's a lad at Man City called Cole Palmer, who no one outside of City had heard of before the start of the season, and he's been the best player for England so far. And he's probably one of the only ones in the group that doesn't get regular games, but he's the one that everybody looks to in that team now that they want him to change games for them, and that's one of the beauties of covering the under-21s, is that you see stories like this. And I always like to think back to watching Aaron Ramsdale over the last few weeks has been interesting, because you get to, the great thing about the under-21s is that you get to talk in quite a relaxed setting with these young lads, and you get to kind of know what they're about. And it's not quite as relaxed post-COVID for, a number of reasons, but to watch Ramsdale grow has been quite heartening, because it was obvious that he had the right mentality and needed a bit of a rub of the green. And it was clear that he was going to become a proper goalkeeper at the top flight. And it's great that it's happened so soon.
Nick, how many of those under-21s do you think could potentially start in Qatar? On your toes there, sorry.
Gareth Well, it was a lot. It was the last meetup, wasn't it? I think he was talking about Smith Rowe, and he exercised caution a little bit. Says, like, you know, you've got to earn this. You've got to earn this call. But with just 13 months or so to go before the World Cup, if he continues to play like he is playing and like he is doing, there is no reason why Smith Rowe wouldn't be able to crack the squad. And like Jack said, it's, I think this under 21 group probably don't have the sort of the stardust in terms of sort of the names that they've previously been, because they're still on the early, and it sounds strange to say early part of their careers when they're still in the under 21 setup. But previously, when you've had Maddison, Foden, Wan-Bissaka, Henderson, Abraham, Gray in all one squad for the Euros in 2019, those were household names already. These guys like Cole Palmer, as an exceptional player as he is, they haven't kind of got to sort of the pub table talk around the country just yet. So I think that probably helps them to be under the radar, helping them develop without kind of the intensity of that spotlight all the time, will help them. But when they continue to play like they are, when Smith Rowe does, when Cole Palmer does, and continues to press for Manchester City, that'll come. And it's something they're going to have to learn. But I think they're probably, at the minute, within the under 21 group, I think they're probably in the best place for them at the minute.
Exciting times in terms of depth for squads. So when it comes to the World Cup, absolutely up for the five sub rule. I'm a hypocrite. guys, thank you so much for joining us. We'll see who's in charge of which club by the end of next week. You are in the know.